This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Book of Dust, Volume 2, The Secret Commonwealth, by Philip Pullman. Read for you by Michael Sheen.
Author's Note: The Secret Commonwealth is the second part of The Book of Dust. The central character, Lyra Silvertongue, once known as Lyra Belacqua, was also the protagonist of a previous trilogy, Is Dark Materials. In fact, her name was both the first word and the last in that work. In that story, she was about 11 or 12 years old. In the first part of The Book of Dust, La Belle Sauvage, Lyra was a baby. Although she was central to the story, most of the action of that book concerned a boy called Malcolm Polstead, himself about 11 years old. In this book, we skip 20 years or so. The events of His Dark Materials are 10 years in the past. Both Malcolm and Lyra are adults. The events of La Belle Sauvage are even further away in time. But events have consequences. And sometimes, the effects of what we once did take a long time to become fully apparent. At the same time, the world moves on. Power and influence shift or increase or diminish. And the problems and concerns of adult people are not necessarily the same as the ones they had when young. Lyra and Malcolm, as I say, are not children anymore. Philip Pullman. Everything possible to be believed is an image of truth. William Blake. Chapter 1. Moonlight and Bloodshed. Pantalaimon, the demon of Lyra Belacqua, now called Lyra Silvertongue, lay along the windowsill of Lyra's little study bedroom in St. Sophia's College, in a state as far from thought as he could get. He was aware of the cold draught from the ill-fitting sash window beside him, and of the warm naphtha light on the desk below the window, and of the scratching of Lyra's pen, and of the darkness outside. It was the cold and the dark he most wanted just then. As he lay there, turning over to feel the cold now on his back, now on his front, the desire to go outside became even stronger than his reluctance to speak to Lyra. "Open the window," he said finally. "I want to go out." Lyra's pen stopped moving. She pushed her chair back and stood up. Pantalaimon could see her reflection in the glass, suspended over the Oxford night. He could even make out her expression of mutinous unhappiness. "I know what you're going to say," he said. "Of course I'll be careful. I'm not stupid." "In some ways you are," she said. She reached over him and slid the window up, propping it open with the nearest book. "Don't," he began. "Don't shut the window, yes, Pan. Just sit there freezing till Pan decides to come home. I'm not stupid at all. Go on, bugger off." He flowed out and into the ivy covering the wall of the college. Only the faintest rustle came to Lyra's ears, and then only for a moment. Pan didn't like the way they were speaking to each other, or rather not speaking. In fact, these words were the first they'd exchanged all day. But he didn't know what to do about it. And neither did she. Halfway down the wall, he caught a mouse in his needle-sharp teeth and wondered about eating it, but gave it a surprise and let it go. He crouched on the thick ivy branch, relishing all the smells, all the wayward gusts of air, all the wide, open night around him. But he was going to be careful. He had to be careful about two things. One was the patch of cream-white fur that covered his throat, which stood out with unfortunate clarity against the rest of his red-brown pine-marten fur. But it wasn't hard to keep his head down, or to run fast. The other reason for being careful was much more serious. No one who saw him would think for a moment that he was a pine-marten. He looked like a pine-marten in every respect, but he was a demon. It was very hard to say where the difference lay. But any human being in Lyra's world would have known it at once, as surely as they knew the smell of coffee or the color red. And a person apart from their demon, or a demon alone with their person nowhere in sight, was something uncanny, eldritch, impossible. No ordinary human beings could separate in that way, though reputedly witches could. The power that Lyra and Pan had was peculiar to them, and had been dearly bought 8 years before in the world of the dead. Since coming home to Oxford, after that strange adventure, they had told no one about it, and exercised the most scrupulous care to keep it a secret. But sometimes, and more often recently, they simply had to get away from each other. So now Pan kept to the shadows, and as he moved through the shrubs and the long grass that bordered the great expanse of the neatly mown university parks, feeling the night with all his senses, he made no sound and kept his head low. It had rained earlier that evening, and the earth was soft and moist under his feet. When he came to a patch of mud, he crouched down and pressed his throat and chest into it so as to conceal the treacherous patch of cream-white fur. Leaving the parks, he darted across Banbury Road at a moment when there were no pedestrians on the pavement, and only one distant vehicle in sight. Then he slipped into the garden of one of the large houses on the other side, and then through hedges, over walls, under fences, across lawns, making for Jericho and the canal only a few streets away. Once he reached the muddy towpath, he felt safer. There were bushes and long grass to hide in, and trees up which he could dart as quickly as a fire along a fuse. This semi-wild part of the city was the place he liked best. He had swum in every one of the many stretches of water that laced Oxford through and through. Not only the canal, but also the wide body of the Thames itself, and its tributary the Cherwell, as well as the countless little streams diverted from the main flows to power a mill or feed an ornamental lake, some running underground and out of sight until they emerged beneath this college wall, or behind that burial ground or brewery. At the point where one of these streams ran next to the canal with only the towpath between them, Pan crossed over a little iron bridge and followed the stream down to the great open space of the allotment gardens, with the Oxpens cattle market to the north and the Royal Mail depot beside the railway station on the western side. The moon was full, and a few stars were visible between the racing wisps of cloud. The light made it more dangerous for him, but Pan loved the cold silver clarity as he prowled through the allotments, slipping between the stalks of Brussels sprouts or cauliflowers, the leaves of onions or spinach, making no more noise than a shadow. He came to a tool shed and leaped up to lie flat on the hard tar-paper roof and gaze across the wide open meadow towards the mail depot. That was the only place in the city that seemed awake. Pan and Lyra had come here more than once before together and watched as the trains came in from the north and south to stand steaming at the platform while the workers unloaded sacks of letters and parcels onto large-wheeled baskets and rolled them into the great metal-sided shed, where the mail for London and the continent would be sorted in time for the morning zeppelin. The airship was tethered fore and aft nearby, swinging and swaying in the wind as the mooring line snapped and clanged against the mast. Lights glowed on the platform, on the mooring mast, above the doors of the Royal Mail building. Railway trucks clattered in a siding. A metal door somewhere closed with a bang. Pan saw a movement along the allotments to his right, and very slowly turned his head to look. A cat was creeping along a line of cabbages or broccoli, intent on a mouse. But before the cat could spring, a silent white shape, bigger than Pan himself, swooped down from the sky and seized the mouse, to fly up again out of reach of the cat's claws. The owl's wings beat in perfect silence as it made its way back to one of the trees behind Paradise Square. The cat sat down, seeming to think about the matter, and then resumed the hunt among the vegetables. The moon was bright now, higher in the sky and almost clear of the cloud, and Pan could see every detail of the allotments and the cattle market from his vantage point on the shed. Greenhouses. Scarecrows, galvanized iron cattle pens, water butts, fences rotted and sagging, or upright and neatly painted, pea sticks tied together like naked teepees. They all lay silent in the moonlight, like a stage set for a play of ghosts. Pan whispered, "Lyra, what's happened to us?" There was no answer. The mail train had been unloaded, and now it blew a brief whistle before starting to move. It didn't come out on the rail line that crossed the river southwards just past the allotments, but moved slowly forward and then slowly back into a siding with a great clanking of wagons. Clouds of steam rose from the engine, to be whipped away in shreds by the cold wind. On the other side of the river, beyond the trees, another train was coming in. It wasn't a mail train. It didn't stop at the depot, but went 300 yards further on and into the railway station itself. This was the slow local train from Reading, Pan guessed. He heard it pull up at the platform with a distant hiss of steam and muted screech of brakes. Something else was moving. From Pan's left, where an iron bridge crossed the river, a man was walking, or rather hurrying, with an air of furtive haste along the riverbank where the reeds grew thickly. At once, Pan flowed down off the shed roof and ran silently towards him through onion beds and lines of cabbages. Dodging through fences and under a rusting steel water tank, he came to the edge of the allotment grounds and stood looking through a broken fence panel at the grassy meadow beyond. The man was moving up in the direction of the Royal Mail Depot, going more and more carefully until he stopped by a willow on the bank 100 yards or so from the depot gate, almost opposite where Pan was crouching under the allotment's fence. Even Pan's keen eyes could hardly make him out in the shadow. If he looked away for a moment, he'd lose the man altogether. Then, nothing. The man might have vanished entirely. A minute went past, then another. In the city behind Pan, distant bells began to strike, twice each, 12:30. Pan looked along the trees beside the river. A little way to the left of the willow there stood an old oak, bare and stark in its winter leaflessness. On the right, a single figure was climbing over the gate of the Royal Mail Depot. The newcomer jumped down and then hurried along the riverbank towards the willow where the first man was waiting. A cloud covered the moon for a few moments, and in the shadows, Pan slipped under the fence and then bounded across the wet grass as fast as he could go, keeping low, mindful of that owl, mindful of the man in hiding, making for the oak. As soon as he reached it, he sprang up, extending his claws to catch at the bark, and propelled himself up onto a high branch from which he could see the willow clearly, just as the moon came out again. The man from the mail depot was hurrying towards it. When he was nearly there, moving more slowly, peering into the shadows, the first man stepped out quietly and said a soft word. The second man replied in the same tone, and then they both retreated into the darkness. They were just too far away for Pan to hear what they'd said, but there was a tone of complicity in it. They'd planned to meet here. Their demons were both dogs, a sort of mastiff and a short-legged dog. The dogs wouldn't be able to climb, but they could sniff him out, and Pan pressed himself even closer to the broad bough he was lying on. He could hear a quiet whisper from the men, but again could make out none of the words. Between the high chain-link fence of the mail depot and the river, a path led from the open meadow next to the allotments towards the railway station. It was the natural way to go to the station from the parish of St. Ebbs and the narrow streets of houses that crowded along the river near the gasworks. Looking from the branch of the oak tree, Pan could see further along the path than the men down below and saw someone coming from the direction of the station before they did. A man on his own, the collar of his coat turned up against the cold. Then came a shh from the shadows under the willow. The men had seen the new arrival, too. Earlier that day, in an elegant 17th-century house near the Cathedral of St. Peter in Geneva, two men were talking. They were in a book-lined room on the second floor, whose windows looked out on a quiet street in the somber light of a winter afternoon. There was a long mahogany table set with blotters, pads of paper, pens and pencils, glasses and carafes of water. But the men were sitting in armchairs on either side of a log fire. The host was Marcel Delamere, the Secretary General of an organization known informally by the name of the building they occupied, the one in which this meeting was taking place. It was called La Maison Juste. Delamere was in his early 40s, bespectacled, well-groomed, his perfectly tailored suit matching the color of his dark gray hair. His demon was a snowy owl, who perched on the back of his armchair, her yellow eyes fixed on the demon in the other man's hands, a scarlet snake winding herself through and through his fingers. The visitor was called Pierre Binot. He was in his 60s, austere in a clerical collar, and he was the Chief Justice of the Consistorial Court, the main agency of the Magisterium for enforcing discipline and security.
"Well?" said Binot.
"Another member of the scientific staff at the Lop-Nor station has disappeared," said Delamere.
"Why? What does your agent say about it?"
"The official line is that the missing man and his companion were lost among the watercourses, which changed their position rapidly and without warning. It is a very difficult place, and anyone leaving the station must take a guide. But our agent tells me that there is a rumor that they entered the desert, which begins beyond the lake. There are local legends about gold."
"Local legends be damned. These people were experimental theologians, botanists, men of science. They were after the roses, not gold. What are you saying? One of them disappeared? What about the other?"
"He did return to the station, but set off at once for Europe. His name is Hassel. I told you about him last week, but perhaps you were too busy to hear me. My agent believes that he's carrying samples of the rose materials and a number of papers."
"Have we captured him yet?"
Delamere composed himself almost visibly. "If you remember, Pierre," he said after a moment, "I would have had him detained in Venice. That idea was overruled by your people. Let him get to Britain and then follow him to discover his destination. That was the order. Well, he has now arrived there, and tonight he will be intercepted."
"Let me know as soon as you have those materials. Now, this other matter, the young woman, what do you know about her?"
"The alethiometer—"
"No, no, no. Old-fashioned, vague, too full of speculation. Give me facts, Marcel."
"We have a new reader who—"
"Oh, yes, I've heard of him. New method. Any better than the old one?"
"Times change, and understandings must change, too."
"What does that mean?"
"It means that we've discovered some things about the girl that were not clear before. It seems that she is under certain protections, legal and otherwise. I would like to begin by taking down the network of defense around her. Unobtrusively, quietly, one might say invisibly, and when she is vulnerable, that will be the time to take action. Until then—"
"Cautious," said Binot, standing up. "Too cautious, Marcel. It's a big fault. You need to be decisive, take action, find her, acquire her, and bring her here. But have it your own way. I won't overrule you this time."
Delamere rose to shake his visitor's hand and see him out. When they were alone, his demon flew to his shoulder, and they stood at the window to watch the Chief Justice bustle away, one attendant carrying his briefcase, another holding an umbrella against the snow that had just begun to fall. "I do dislike being interrupted," said Delamere. "I don't think he noticed," said his demon. "Oh, he'll be aware of it one day." The man coming from the railway station was moving quickly. In less than a minute, he was almost at the tree. and as soon as he got there, the other men struck. One stepped out and swung a heavy stick to strike him at his knees. He dropped at once, grunting with shock, and then the other man was on him, chopping down with a short club, striking his head, his shoulders, his arms. No one uttered a word. The victim's demon, a small hawk, rose into the air, crying and fluttering violently, and kept falling down as her man weakened under the blows. But then Pan saw a flash of moonlight reflected on a knife blade, and the man from the mail depot cried out and fell, but the other attacker struck again and again, and the victim fell still. Pan heard every blow. The man was dead. The second man stood up and looked at his companion.
"What did he do?" he said quietly. "Cut my bloody hamstrings, bastard. Look, I'm bleeding like a pig."
The man's demon, the Mastiff Cross, was whining and writhing on the ground beside him.
"Can you get up?"
The killer's voice was thick and muffled, as if he was speaking through Qatar, and he had a Liverpool accent.
"What do you think?"
Their voices hardly rose above a whisper.
"Can you move at all?"
The first man tried to push himself up. There was another grunt of pain. The second man offered his hand, and the first managed to stand, but it was obvious that he could only use one leg.
"What are we going to do?" he said.
The moon lit them all brilliantly. The killer, and the man who couldn't walk, and the dead man. Pan's heart was thumping so hard that he thought they must be able to hear it.
"You stupid sod. Couldn't you see he was holding a knife?" said the killer. "He was too quick. You're supposed to be good at this. Get out the way."
The first man hobbled back a pace or two. The killer bent down and picked up the dead man's ankles and hauled the body backwards and into the rushes. Then the killer reappeared and impatiently beckoned the other man forward.
"Lean on me," he said. "I got half a mind to leave you here on your own. Just a bloody liability. Now I've got to come back and deal with him myself, and that bleeding moon's getting brighter all the time. Where's his bag? Wasn't he carrying a bag?"
"He never had a bag. He never had nothing."
"He must have done. Oh, sod it.
Barry will come back with you and help."
"Now, too noisy, too nervous. Give us your arm. Come on, hurry up."
"Oh, Christ, be careful. Ah, that hurts."
"Now shut up and move as fast as you can. I don't care if it hurts. Just keep your bloody mouth shut."
The first man put his arm around the killer's shoulders and limped along beside him as they moved slowly beneath the oak tree and back along the riverbank. Pan, looking down, saw a patch of blood on the grass, shining red in the moonlight. He waited till the men were out of sight and then prepared to jump down. But before he could move, something stirred in the rushes where the man's body lay, and something pale and bird-sized fluttered up, falling and flying up again, failing, dropping, but with a last burst of life, making directly for Pan. He was too frightened to move. If the man was dead. But this demon looked dead herself. So what could he do? Pan was ready to fight, to flee, to faint, but then she was right there on the branch beside him, struggling to stay there, almost falling off, and he had to reach out and catch her. She felt icy cold, and alive, but only just. The man wasn't quite dead.
"Help,"
she whispered raggedly.
"Help us."
"Yes," he said, "yes."
"Quickly."
She fell off, and managed to flutter down to the rushes. In a moment, Pan had flowed down the trunk of the oak and bounded across towards where she'd vanished, and found the man lying there in the rushes, still just breathing, with the demon pressing herself against his cheek. Pan heard her say,
"A demon. Separate."
The man turned his head a little and groaned. Pan heard the grating of bone against broken bone.
"Separate,"
the man murmured.
"Yes. We learned to do it."
"My lucky day. Inside pocket. Here."
He raised a hand with enormous effort and touched the right side of his jacket.
"Take it out,"
he whispered, trying not to hurt him and fighting the great taboo against touching another person's body, Pan nosed the jacket aside and found a leather wallet in the inside pocket.
That's it. Take it away. Don't let them get it. It's all up to you and your...
Pan tugged, but the wallet wouldn't come because the jacket was caught under the man's body and he couldn't move. But after several seconds of difficulty, Pan got it free and pulled it out onto the ground.
Take it right away, before they come back.
The pale hawk demon was hardly there now, just a wisp of white shadow fluttering and pressing herself to his flesh. Pan hated seeing people die because of what happened to their demons. They vanished like a candle flame going out. He wanted to console this poor creature who knew she was going to disappear, but all she wanted to do was feel a last touch of the warmth she'd found in her man's body all their lives together. The man took a shallow, rasping breath, and then the pretty hawk demon drifted out of existence altogether. And now Pan had to carry this wallet all the way back to St. Sophia's College and Lyra's bed. He gripped it between his teeth and pushed his way up to the edge of the rushes. It wasn't heavy, but it was awkward. And what was worse, it was saturated with the smell of another person. Sweat, cologne, smoke leaf. It was being too close to someone who wasn't Lyra. He got it as far as the fence around the allotment gardens, and then stopped for a rest. Well, he would have to take his time. There was plenty of night left. Lyra was deep in sleep when a shock woke her up, like a sudden fall, something physical. But what? She reached for Pan, and remembered that he wasn't there. So had something happened to him? It was far from the first night she'd had to go to bed alone, and she hated it. Oh, the folly of going out by himself in that way. But he wouldn't listen. He wouldn't stop doing it. And one day, they'd both pay the price. She lay awake for a minute, but sleep was gathering around her again, and soon she surrendered and closed her eyes. The bells of Oxford were striking 2 o'clock when Pan climbed in. He laid the wallet on the table, working his mouth this way and that to relieve his aching jaw, before pulling out the book with which she'd propped open the window for him. He knew it. It was a novel called The Hypercharasmians, and Pan thought Lyra was paying it far too much attention. He let it fall to the floor, and then cleaned himself meticulously before pushing the wallet into the bookcase and out of sight. Then he leaped up lightly onto her pillow. In the ray of moonlight that came through a gap in the curtains, he crouched and gazed at her sleeping face. Her cheeks were flushed. Her dark gold hair was damp. Those lips that had whispered to him so often, and kissed him, and kissed Will too, were compressed. A little frown hovered on her brow, coming and going like clouds in a windy sky. They all spoke of things that were not right, of a person who was becoming more and more unreachable to him, as he was to her. And he had no idea what to do about it. All he could do was lie down close against her flesh. That, at least, was still warm and welcoming. At least, they were still alive. Chapter 2. Their clothes smelled of roses. Lyra woke up to hear the college clock striking 8. In the first few minutes of drowsy surfacing, before thought began to interfere, her sensations were delicious, and one of them was the warmth of her demon's fur around her neck. This sensuous, mutual cherishing had been part of her life for as long as she could remember. She lay there, trying not to think, but thought was like a tide coming in, little trickles of awareness, an essay to finish, her clothes that needed washing. The knowledge that unless she got to the hall by 9 o'clock there'd be no breakfast kept flowing in from this direction or that, and undermining the sandcastle of her sleepiness. And then the biggest ripple yet. Pan, and their estrangement. Something had come between them, and neither of them knew fully what it was, and the only person each could confide in was the other, and that was the one thing they couldn't do. She pushed the blankets away and stood up, shivering, because St. Sophia's was parsimonious where heating was concerned. A quick wash in the little basin where the hot water knocked and shook the pipes in protest before condescending to appear, and then she pulled on the tartan skirt and the light grey jersey that were more or less the only clean things she had. And all the time, Pan lay, pretending to sleep on the pillow. It was never like that when they were young. Never. "Pan," she said wearily. He had to come, and she knew he would. And he stood up and stretched and let her lift him to her shoulder. She left the room and started downstairs. "Lyra, let's pretend we're talking to each other," he whispered. "I don't know if pretending's a good way to live." "It's better than not. I want to tell you what I saw last night. It's important."
"Why didn't you tell me when you came in?"
"You were asleep."
"I wasn't, any more than you were just now."
"Then why didn't you know I had something important to tell you?"
"I did. I felt something happen. But I knew I'd have to argue to get you to tell me about it, frankly."
He said nothing. Lyra stepped out at the foot of her staircase and into the dank chill of the morning. One or two girls were walking towards the hall. More were coming away, having had breakfast, stepping briskly out to the morning's work, to the library, or to a lecture or tutorial.
"Oh, I don't know," she finished. "I'm tired of this. Tell me after breakfast."
She climbed the steps into the hall and helped herself to porridge and took her bowl to a spare place at one of the long tables and sat down. All around her, girls of her own age were finishing their scrambled eggs or porridge or toast, some chatting happily, some looking dull or tired or preoccupied, one or two reading letters or just eating stolidly. She knew many of them by name, some just by sight. Some were friends cherished for their kindness or their wit, some just acquaintances. A small number, not exactly enemies, but young women she knew she would never like because they were snobbish or arrogant or cold. She felt as much at home in this scholastic community, among these brilliant or hard-working or gossipy contemporaries, as she did anywhere else. She should have been happy. As she stirred some milk into her porridge, Lyra became aware of the girl opposite. She was called Miriam Jacobs, a pretty, dark-haired girl, sufficiently quick and clever to get by academically without doing more work than the minimum. A little vain, but good-natured enough to let herself be teased about it. A squirrel demon, Syriax, was clinging to her hair, looking stricken, and Miriam was reading a letter, one hand on her mouth. Her face was pale. No one else had noticed. As Miriam put the letter down, Lyra leaned across the table and said, "Miriam, what is it?" Miriam blinked and sighed as if she were coming awake, and pushed the letter down onto her lap.
"Home," she said. "Something silly."
A demon crept onto her lap with the letter while Miriam went through an elaborate demonstration of not caring that was wasted on her neighbors, who hadn't been watching anyway.
"Nothing I can help with?" asked Lyra.
Pan had joined Syriax under the table. Both girls could sense that their demons were talking, and that whatever Syriax told Pan would be in Lyra's knowledge very soon. Miriam looked at Lyra helplessly. Another moment, and she might burst into tears. Lyra stood up and said, "Come on." The other girl was in that state in which any decisiveness from anyone is seized like a lifebelt in a rough sea. She went with Lyra out of the hall, clutching her demon to her breast, not asking where they were going, just following like a lamb. "I'm sick to death of porridge and cold toast and dry scrambled eggs," said Lyra. "There's only one thing to do in a case like this."
"What's that?" said Miriam.
"George's."
"But I've got a lecture."
"No, the lecturer's got a lecture, but you haven't and I haven't, and I want fried eggs and bacon. Come along, step out. Were you a girl guide?"
"No."
"Neither was I. I don't know why I asked."
"I've got an essay to do."
Do you know anyone who hasn't got an essay to do? There are thousands of young ladies and gentlemen all behind with their essays. It would be bad form to be anything else. And George's is waiting. The Cadena's not open yet, or we could go there. Come on, it's chilly. Do you want to get a coat?
Yes, just quickly then.
They ran up to get their coats. Lyra's was a shabby green thing that was a little too small. Miriam's coat was of navy cashmere and fitted her perfectly. And if anyone says why weren't you at the lecture or the seminar or whatever, you can say that you were upset and nice Lyra took you for a walk. Lyra said as they went out through the lodge.
I've never been to George's, said Miriam.
Oh, go on, you must have.
I know where it is, but I don't know. I just thought it wasn't for us.
George's was a cafe in the covered market, much used by market traders and workers from roundabout.
I've been going there since I was young, said Lyra.
I mean, really young. I used to hang around outside till they gave me a bun to go away.
Did you? Really?
A bun or a clout. I even worked there for a bit, washing dishes, making tea and coffee. I was about 9, I think.
Did your parents let... Oh, God, sorry.
The only thing Lyra's friends knew about her background was that her parents were people of great family on both sides who had died when she was young. It was understood that this was a source of great sorrow to Lyra, and that she never talked about it, so naturally their speculation flourished. Now Miriam was mortified.
No, I was in the care of Jordan by then, Lyra said cheerfully.
If they'd known, I mean if the Jordan people had known, they'd have been surprised, I suppose, but then they'd have forgotten about it and I'd have kept on going there anyway. I sort of did what I wanted.
Didn't anyone know what you were doing?
The housekeeper, Mrs. Lonsdale. She was pretty fierce. I was always getting told off, but she knew it wouldn't do any good. I could be quite well behaved when I needed to be.
How old were you when... Sorry, I don't mean to pry.
The first thing I remember is when I was taken to Jordan for the first time. I don't know how old I was. Probably just a baby. I was being carried by a big man. It was midnight and stormy, with lightning and thunder and pouring rain. He was on a horse, and I was wrapped up inside his cloak. Then he was banging on a door with a pistol, and the door opened, and it was all warm and light inside. And then he handed me over to someone else, and I think he kissed me, and got on his horse, and rode away. He was probably my father.
Miriam was very impressed. In truth, Lyra wasn't sure about the horse, but she liked it.
That's so romantic, Miriam said. And that's the first thing you remember.
The very first. After that, I was just living in Jordan. Have been ever since. What's the first thing you remember?
The smell of roses, said Miriam at once.
What, a garden somewhere?
No, my father's factory, where they make soap and things. I was sitting on his shoulders and we were in the bottling plant. Such an intense, sweet smell. The men's clothes used to smell of it, and their wives had to wash them to get it out.
Lyra was aware that Miriam's family was rich, and that soaps and perfumes and such things were behind their wealth. Miriam had a vast collection of scents and fragrant ointments and shampoos, and it was a favourite occupation of her friends to try out all the new ones. Suddenly Lyra realised that the other girl was weeping. She stopped and took Miriam's arm.
Miriam, what is it? Was it that letter? Daddy's bankrupt, Miriam said shakily. It's all over. That's what it is. So now you know. Oh, Miriam, that's awful. And we won't... They can't... They're selling the house. They'll have to leave college. They can't afford...
She couldn't go on. Lyra held out her arms. Miriam leaned against her, sobbing. Lyra could smell the fragrance of her shampoo, and wondered if there were roses in that, too.
Hush, she said. You know there are bursaries and special funds, and you won't have to leave, you'll see. But everything's going to change. They're having to sell everything and move to... I don't know. And Danny will have to leave Cambridge, and it's all going to be horrible.
I bet it sounds worse than it is, said Lyra. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see Pan whispering to Syriax, and she knew he was saying just the same sort of thing. Of course, it was a shock, learning about it in a letter over breakfast. But people survive this sort of thing, honest, and sometimes things turn out much better than you think. I bet you won't have to leave college.
But everyone will know.
So what? It's nothing to be ashamed of. Things happen to people's families all the time, and it's not their fault. If you cope with it by being brave, people will admire you for it.
It's not Daddy's fault, after all.
Of course not, said Lyra, who had no idea. Like they teach us in economic history, the trade cycle, things that are too big to resist.
It just happened, and no one saw it coming.
Miriam was fumbling in her pocket. She brought out the crumpled letter and read,
"The suppliers have simply been so unreasonable, and although Daddy has been to Latakia again and again, he can't find a good source anywhere. Apparently the big medical companies are buying everything up before anyone else can. There's absolutely nothing one can do. It's too awful."
"Suppliers of what?" said Lyra. "Roses?"
"Yes. They buy them from the gardens over there and distill them or something. Attar of roses. Something like that."
"Don't English roses do?"
"I don't think so. It has to be roses from there."
"Or lavender? There's lots of that."
I don't know.
"I suppose the men will lose their jobs," Lyra said as they turned into Broad Street opposite Bodley's library. "The men whose clothes smelled of roses."
"Probably. Oh, it's awful."
"It is. But you can cope with it. Now, when we sit down, we'll make a plan of what you can do, all the options, all the possibilities, and then you'll feel better at once. You'll see." In the cafe, Lyra ordered bacon and eggs and a pint of tea. Miriam didn't want anything except coffee, but Lyra told George to bring a currant bun anyway. "If she doesn't eat it, I will," she said.
"Don't they feed you in that college?" said George, a man whose hands moved faster than anyone's Lyra had ever seen, slicing, buttering, pouring, shaking salt, cracking eggs. When she was young, she'd greatly admired his ability to crack 3 eggs at once into a frying pan with one hand and not spill a drop of white or break the yolk or include a fragment of shell. One day, she got through 2 dozen trying it herself. That had earned her a clout, which she had to admit she deserved. George was more respectful these days. She still couldn't do the egg trick. Lyra borrowed a pencil and a piece of paper from George and drew 3 columns. One headed, "Things to Do," the next, "Things to Find Out," and the third, "Things to Stop Worrying About." And she and Miriam and their 2 demons filled them in with suggestions and ideas as they ate. Miriam finished the currant bun, and by the time they'd covered the paper, she was almost cheerful. "There," said Lyra. "It's always a good idea to come to George's. St. Sophia's breakfasts are very high-minded. As for Jordan, I bet they're not austere like ours. Socking great silver chafing dishes full of kedgeree or deviled kidneys or kippers. Must keep the young gentlemen in the style to which they're accustomed. Lovely, but I wouldn't want it every day."
"Thank you, Lyra," said Miriam. "I feel much better. You were quite right.
So what are you going to do now?"
"Go and see Dr. Bell, then write home."
Dr. Bell was Miriam's moral tutor, a sort of pastoral guide and mentor. She was a brusque but kindly woman. She'd know what the college could do to help.
"Good,"
said Lyra, "and tell me what happens."
"I will," Miriam promised.
Lyra sat there for a few minutes after Miriam had gone, chatting to George, regretfully turning down his offer of work in the Christmas vacation, finishing her pint mug of tea. But eventually came the time when she and Pan were alone again.
"What did he tell you?"
she said to him, meaning Miriam's demon.
"What she's really worried about is her boyfriend. She doesn't know how to tell him because she thinks he won't like her if she isn't rich. He's a cardinal's, some kind of aristocrat."
"So we spent all that time and effort, and she didn't even tell me the thing she was worried about most?"
"Phew, I don't think much of that," Lyra said, gathering up her shabby coat.
"And if that's how he feels, he's not worth it anyway."
"Pan, I'm sorry," she said, surprising herself as much as him.
You were just going to tell me what you saw last night, and I didn't have time to answer before. She waved to George as they left.
I saw someone being murdered, he said.
Chapter 3 Left Luggage. Lyra stood still. They were outside the coffee merchants by the entrance to the covered market, and the air was full of the smell of roasting coffee.
What did you say? She said. I saw two men attack another man and kill him. It was down by the allotment gardens near the Royal Mail Depot.
As she walked slowly out into Market Street and headed back towards St. Sophia's, he told her the whole story.
And they seemed to know about separation, he said. The man who was killed and his demon, they could do it. She must have seen me on the branch, and she flew straight up, well, with an effort, because he was hurt. And she wasn't frightened or anything. I mean, not frightened of me being alone like most people would be. And he was the same. And this wallet, where is it now? In our bookshelves, next to the German dictionary. And what was it he said? He said, take it away. Don't let them get it. It's all up to you and your... And then he died.
All up to us? She said. Well, you'd better have a look at it. They turned on the gas fire in her study bedroom at St. Sophia's, sat at the table, and switched on the little ambaric lamp because the sky was grey and the light was gloomy. Lyra took out the wallet from the bookshelf. It was a simple one-fold wallet without a clasp, the whole thing little bigger than her palm. There had originally been a raised grain in the leather, like that of Morocco, but most of that was worn away to a greasy smoothness. It might once have been brown, too, but it was nearly black now, and marked in several places by Pan's gripping teeth. She could smell it, a faint, slightly pungent, slightly spicy smell, like that of a man's cologne mixed with sweat. Pan waved a paw in front of his nose. She examined the outside carefully for any mark or monogram, but there was none. She opened the wallet and again found it perfectly normal, perfectly ordinary. There were 4 banknotes, $6 and 100 francs in all, not a large sum. In the next pocket, she found a train ticket for the return journey from Paris to Marseille. Was he French? Said Pan. Don't know yet, said Lyra. Look, here's a picture. From the next pocket in the wallet, she took out a grubby and much-handled card attesting to the identity of the owner, with a photogram showing the face of a man of 40, possibly, with black, curly hair and a thin moustache.
That's him, Pan said.
The card had been issued by His Majesty's Foreign Office to Anthony John Roderick Hassel, who was a British citizen and whose birth date showed him to be 38 years old. The demon photogram displayed a small, hawk-like bird of prey. Pan gazed at the pictures with intense interest and pity. The next thing she found was a small card she recognized, because she had one identical to it in her own purse. It was a Bodleian library card. Pan made a small noise of surprise.
He must have belonged to the university, he said. Look, what's that?
It was another card. This one issued by the University Department of Botany. It certified Dr. Roderick Hassel as a member of staff of the Department of Plant Sciences.
Why would they want to attack him? Lyra said, not expecting an answer. Did he look rich, or was he carrying something, or what?
They did say, said Pan, trying to remember, one of them, the killer... He was surprised that the man wasn't carrying a bag. Sounded as if they'd been expecting him to. But the other man, the one who'd been wounded, wasn't interested in thinking about that.
Was he carrying a bag, or a briefcase, or a suitcase, or anything?
No, nothing.
The next paper she found was much folded and refolded, and reinforced with tape along the creases. It was headed, Laissez passer.
What's that? Said Pan. Kind of passport, I think.
It had been issued by the Ministry of Internal Security of the Sublime Porte of the Ottoman Empire at Constantinople. It said in French, English, and Anatolian that Anthony John Roderick Hassel, botanist of Oxford, Britain, was to be allowed to travel through the realms of the Ottoman Empire, and that the authorities were to give him assistance and protection whenever needed.
How big is the Ottoman Empire? Said Pan.
Enormous.
Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt and Libya and thousands of miles east as well, I think. Wait, here's another. And one more behind that. The other two documents had been issued by the Khanate of Turkestan, including the regions of Bactria and Sogdiana, and the prefecture of Sinkiang in the celestial empire of Cathay. They said much the same thing, in much the same way as the laissez-passer from the Ottoman Empire. They're out of date, said Lyra. But the Sinkiang one is earlier than the Turkestan one. That means he was coming from there and it took him 3 months. It's a long way. There's something else in here. Her fingers had found another paper hidden in an inside pocket. She tugged it out and unfolded it to find something quite different from the rest. A leaflet from a steamship company, advertising a cruise to the Levant on a vessel called the SS Zenobia. It was issued by the Imperial Orient Line, and the English language text promised a world of romance and sunshine. A world of silks and perfumes, Pan read, of carpets and sweetmeats, of damascene swords, of the glint of beautiful eyes beneath the star-filled sky. Dance to the romantic music of Carlo Pomerini and his Salon Serenade Orchestra, Lyra read, thrill to the whisper of moonlight on the tranquil waters of the Mediterranean. How can moonlight whisper? An Imperial Orient Levantine cruise is the gateway to a world of loveliness. Oh, wait, Pan, look. On the back, there was a timetable showing the dates of arrival and departure at various ports. The ship would leave London on Thursday, April the 17th, and return to Southampton on Friday, May 23rd, calling at 14 cities en route. And someone had circled the date Monday, May the 12th, when the Zenobia called at Smyrna, and drawn a line from that to the scribbled words, Café Antalya, Suleiman Square, 11 a.m. An appointment, said Pan. He sprang from the table to the mantelpiece and stood, paws against the wall, to scrutinize the calendar that hung there. It's not this year. Wait, it's next year, he said. Those are the right days of the week. It hasn't happened yet. What are we going to do? Well, said Lyra, we really ought to take it to the police. I mean, there's no doubt about that, is there? Nope, said Pan, jumping back onto the table. He turned the papers around to read them more closely. Is that everything in the wallet? I think so. Lyra looked through it again, pushing her fingers down into the pockets. No, wait, there's something here. A coin? She turned the wallet upside down and shook it. It wasn't a coin that fell out, but a key with a round metal tag attached to it, bearing the number 36. That looks like, said Pan. Yes, we've seen one of those. We've had one of those. When was it? Last year. The railway station. Left luggage, Lyra said. He put something in a left luggage locker. The bag they thought he ought to be carrying. It must be still there. They looked at each other with wide eyes. Then Lyra shook her head. Oh, we should take this to the police, she said. We've done what anyone would have done. We've looked to see who it belonged to and, well, we could take it to the Botanic Garden. The plant sciences place, they'd know who he was. Yes. But we know that he was killed, so it's really a matter for the police. We've got to, Pan. He said. Suppose so. But there's no reason why we shouldn't copy a few things. The dates of his journey, the appointment in Smyrna. She wrote them down. Is that everything? He said. Yes. I'll try and get them all back in the right places, and then we'll go to the police station. Why are we doing this? Really? Copying these things down. She looked at him for a moment, and then turned back to the wallet. Just being curious, she said. It's none of our business, except that we know how it came to be there in the rushes. So it is our business. And he did say it was all up to us. Don't forget that. She turned off the fire, locked the door, and they set off for the main police station in St. Aldate's, with the wallet in her pocket. 25 minutes later, they were waiting at a counter while the duty sergeant dealt with a man who wanted a fishing license, and who wouldn't accept that it was the river authority that issued them, and not the police. He argued at such length that Lyra sat down on the only chair and prepared to wait till lunchtime. Pan was sitting on her lap, watching everything. When two other policemen came out of a back office and stopped to talk by the counter, he turned to look at them, and a moment later, Lyra felt his claws dig into her hand. She didn't react. He'd tell her what it was about in a moment, and so he did, flowing up to her shoulder and whispering,
"That's the man from last night. That's the killer. I'm certain of it."
He meant the taller and heavier of the two policemen. Lyra heard the man say to the other,
"No, it's overtime. Completely legitimate. All done by the book. There's no doubt about it."
His voice was unpleasant, harsh and thick-sounding. He had a Liverpool accent. At the same moment, the man who wanted the fishing license said to the duty sergeant as he turned away,
"Well, if you're sure, I've got no choice, but I'll want it in writing."
"Come back this afternoon, and my colleague will be on the desk then. We'll give you a document all about it," said the sergeant, winking at the other two.
"All right, I will. I'm not giving up."
"No, no, don't do that, sir."
"Yes, miss. How can I help you?"
He was looking at Lyra, and the other two policemen were watching. She stood up and said,
I don't know if I've come to the right place, but my bicycle was stolen."
"Yes, this is the right place, miss. Fill in this form, and we'll see what we can do."
She took the paper he handed her and said,
I'm in a bit of a hurry. Can I bring it back later?"
"Any time, miss."
Her inquiry not being very interesting, he turned away and joined the conversation about overtime. A moment later, Lyra and Pan were out in the street again.
"Well, what do we do now?" said Pan.
"Go to the left luggage place, of course."
But Lyra wanted to see the riverbank first. As they walked across Carfax and down towards the castle, she went over the story with Pan again, each of them being so scrupulously polite and attentive to the other that it was almost painful. Everyone else Lyra could see in the streets or the shops, everyone she'd spoken to in the market, was perfectly at ease with their demon. The cafe owner George's demon, a flamboyant rat, sat in the breast pocket of his apron, passing sardonic comments on everything around her, just as she'd done when Lyra was a small child, completely content with George as he was with her. Only Lyra and Pan were unhappy with each other. So they tried very hard. They went to the allotment gardens and looked at the gate in the high fence around the Royal Mail depot where the second attacker had climbed over, at the path from the railway station that the victim had come along. It was a market day, and as well as the sound of railway cars being shunted in the sidings and the noise of someone using a drill or a grinder to repair a machine in the Royal Mail building, Lyra heard the mooing of cattle from the pens in the distance. There were people everywhere.
"Someone might be watching us," she said. "I suppose they might. So we'll just wander along as if we're daydreaming."
She looked around slowly. They were standing in the area between the river and the allotments, a roughly tended open meadow where people strolled or picnicked in the summer, or bathed from the riverbank or played football. This part of Oxford wasn't home territory for Lyra, whose allegiance had lain mostly with the urchins of Jericho half a mile north. She had fought many battles with the gangs from around here, from St. Ebbs, in the days before she went to the Arctic and left her world altogether. Even now, a young woman of 20, educated, a student of St. Sophia's, she felt an atavistic fear of being in enemy territory. She set off slowly, crossing the grass to the riverbank, trying to look as if she were doing anything other than looking for a murder site. They stopped to look at a train loaded with coal coming slowly down from their right towards the wooden bridge over the river. Trains never crossed it fast. They heard the trundle of the coal trucks over the bridge, and watched the train swing away to the left on the branch line that made for the gasworks, and into the siding next to the main building where the furnaces roared day and night. Lyra said,
"Pan, if they hadn't attacked him, where was he going? Where does the path lead to?"
They were standing at the southern edge of the allotments, where Pan had been when he first saw the men hide under the willow. The two trees were exactly ahead of them as they looked towards the river, about 100 yards away. If the man hadn't been attacked, the path would have taken him further along the bank, where the river curved around to the left. Without discussing it, Lyra and Pan moved slowly that way to see where he would have gone. The path made directly along the bank towards a footbridge over the stream, which in turn led to the narrow streets of back-to-back houses around the gasworks and the parish of St. Ebb's proper.
"So that's where he was going," said Pan. "Even if he didn't know it. Even if he was only following the path. And that's where the other man must have come from, the one who didn't come from the mail depot." "You could get to anywhere from there," Lyra said. "All those tangled old streets in St. Ebb's, and then St. Aldate's and Carfax. Anywhere. But we'll never find it. Not by guessing."
They both knew why they were talking like this, at the end of the footbridge over the stream. Neither of them wanted to go and look at the place where the man had been killed.
"We ought to, though," she said. And he said, "Yes, come on."
They turned back and wandered along the bank of the river, making for the willow and the oak, where rushes grew thickly and the path was muddy. Lyra looked casually all around, but there was no one sinister or threatening. Just some children playing by the stream further back, a few men working their allotments, and an elderly couple on the path ahead walking arm in arm and carrying shopping bags. They passed the old couple, who smiled and nodded when Lyra said, "Good morning," and then they were under the oak tree. Pan leaped up from Lyra's shoulder and showed her where he'd lain along the branch, and then sprang down again and flowed along the grass towards the willow. She followed him, looking for signs of a struggle on the ground, but seeing only grass and trampled mud that was no different from the rest of the path.
"Anyone coming?" she said to Pan.
He jumped up to her shoulder and looked around.
"A woman with a small child and a shopping bag coming over the footbridge. No one else. Let's look in the rushes. About here, was it?" "Yes, right here." "And he pulled the dead man down to the water?" "In among the rushes, but not all the way down. Not when I was watching, anyway. He probably came back later and did that."
Lyra stepped off the path and down the slope where the rushes grew. They were tall, and the slope was steep, and only 6 feet or so from the path she was invisible from anywhere in the meadow. It was hard to keep her footing, and her shoes would be ruined, but she found her balance and crouched down low and looked around carefully. Some of the rushes had been bent over, their stems broken, and something had been pulled down over the mud, something that might easily have been the size of a man. But there was no sign of a body.
"We can't lurk about here too long," she said, clambering out. "We really will look suspicious. Station, then."
As they walked along the path next to the mail depot, they heard the great bell of Cardinal's College tolling 11, and Lyra thought of the lecture that she should be attending just then, the last of the term. Annie and Helen would be there, though, and she could borrow their notes. And perhaps that good-looking shy boy from Magdalen would be sitting at the back as before, and perhaps this time she could have gone to sit right next to him and see what happened, and everything would go back to normal. Except, as long as that locker key was in her pocket, nothing would be normal.
"It used to be you who was impulsive," said Pan, "and me who kept holding you back. We're different now."
She nodded. "Well, you know, things change. We could wait, Pan, and go back to St. Aldate's when that policeman goes off duty. Like this evening, about 6, maybe. They can't all be in a conspiracy with him. There must be someone honest there. This isn't just shoplifting. This is murder."
"I know. I saw it.
And maybe by doing this we'd be helping the murderer get away with it. By interfering with the investigation. That can't be right."
"That's another thing," he said.
"What?"
"You used to be optimistic. You used to think that whatever we did would turn out well. Even after we came back from the north, you used to think that. Now you're cautious, you're anxious, you're pessimistic."
She knew he was right, but it wasn't right that he should speak to her accusingly, as if it was something to blame her for.
"I used to be young," was all she could find to say.
He made no response. They didn't speak again till they reached the railway station. Then she said, "Pan, come here." And he leaped up at once into her hands. She put him on her shoulder and said quietly,
"You're going to have to look out behind. Someone might be watching."
He turned around and settled as she climbed the steps to the entrance.
"Don't go straight to the lockers," he murmured. "Go and look at the magazines first. I'll see if there's anyone just hanging about watching.
She nodded and turned left inside the station doors and wandered over to the bookstall. While she flicked through one magazine after another, Pan looked at all the men and women queuing for tickets, or sitting at tables drinking coffee, or checking the timetables, or asking something at the inquiry desk.
"Everyone seems to be doing something," he said quietly. "I can't see anyone who's just hanging about."
Lyra had the locker key ready in her pocket.
"Shall I go?" she said.
"Yes, go on. But don't hurry. Just walk naturally. Look at the time, or the departures and arrivals board or something."
She replaced the magazine and turned away from the bookstall. It seemed to her that 100 pairs of eyes could have been watching, but she tried to look nonchalant as she sauntered across the floor to the other end of the booking hall, where the left luggage lockers stood.
"All right, so far," said Pan. "No one's watching. Just do it now.